Welcome to Risky Business episode 256, the first of the 9-bit editions. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're taking a look at public transport ticketing security. Some very clever fellows from the US of A have figured out how to reset their RFID tickets with a nifty little app for NFC-enabled smartphones. Now, all this due to some positively boneheaded mistakes made during the initial rollout of some ticketing systems. So that interview with Corey Benninger of Intrepidus Group is coming up a bit later on. This week's show is brought to you by Tenable Network Security, and Tenable's co-founder and CEO, Ron Gula, will be joining the program later on to talk about the possibility of US President Obama issuing an executive order designed to replace the doomed Cybersecurity Act of 2012, which was shot down by the US Congress. That's coming up later on, but before all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with our good buddy, Insomnia Security's Mark Piper, who is filling in for Adam Bylow this week. And Mark, first up in this week's news, big surprise, there's a new Java flaw that apparently, the headline screams, could affect 1 billion users.
Yeah, 1 billion, right? And the thing about this flaw is that's not a out there number.
No.
Basically, the security exploitation guys over in Europe who found a number of the vulnerabilities that were addressed recently after the Zero Day was published in the wild, who have been working through Java, looking primarily on sandbox escape vulnerabilities and various other bits and pieces, have achieved another sandbox bypass. This time it affects Java 5, 6, and 7. And they've confirmed it on Windows 7 32-bit systems with pretty much all the major browsers. So at this stage, there's not a lot of details. It appears to be some sort of type checking issue, and they're currently working through. And from the looks of this post, it's more of just like, you know, a prod in Oracle's direction to get them moving on a fix.
Mm-mm. I mean, it's got a hint of the Dr. Evil about it, doesn't it? The 1 billion users. I mean, this isn't being exploited in the wild, so it's not quite the level of disaster of the previous round.
Yeah, they haven't released much details at all. And as far as we can tell, there's a proof of concept that exists that they've handed on to, like, you know, Oracle to help get them moving on a fix, apparently to disrupt Larry Ellison's morning coffee.
Yes, well, there you go. His morning cup of Java. Oh, zing. Oh, just speaking of other disastrous bugs, Microsoft did wind up patching that IE0 day out of band, so I think everyone would have moved on and sorted that out.
Yeah, no surprises here, right? But most good places are getting used to dealing with, you know, out-of-band IE fixes because they're coming more and more regularly over time. But, you know, I mean, this one was actively used in the wild and was being used to drop PlugX, which is a remote access tool used by the Nitro crew in China. The Metasploit guys are the ones that actually have gone through and done a lot of validation work on this and writing their exploit. So the original samples were only targeting IE 7 and 8 on Windows XP, and they're the ones that have gone through and checked it on 6 through 9. So
yeah, they were like, oh, this looks really bad. Oh, no, wait, it's much worse.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, SourceForge has had don't you just love a good Trojan package? PHPMyAdmin apparently got backdoored, and SourceForge were serving it up as good code.
Yeah, so it looks like one of the CDN network mirrors, so the content distribution platform for SourceForge, got compromised over in Korea, and they decided to add a new interesting file called server sync.php, which basically did what you think it would allow it to do as far as backdoor goes, give you access to the server. So they're saying at the moment SourceForge have investigated it. They reckon the compromise was around the 22nd of September. And around 400 people grabbed the package before they realized it.
PHPMyAdmin, what is it? What is it actually used for?
It's used so developers and server administrators can have a nice usable web interface to MySQL if the command line scares them. It's historically had a raft of bugs because of the privilege required to do database administration that it gives. Basically means, you know, any flaw in PHPMyAdmin that you can get to will ultimately lead to a compromise in the underlying server. So. But yeah, I mean, it's not the first time, you know, SourceForge systems have been compromised. We're pretty sure it won't be the last time. And it just goes to show, you know, package check and a package signing goes a long way when you're installing from raw sources.
Now, here's an interesting piece. A Romanian bloke, a computer security researcher, apparently stumbled across a whole stack of IEEE.org passwords. They were being stored in plain text on a public FTP server. Uh-oh.
This is classic, right? So he's having a look around IEEE's FTP server and he finds, like, you know, some upload Akamai directory and finds 100 gigabits worth of logs. So he downloads them all. And it turns out to be about 360 million HP request logs, which he went and analyzed and had a look over.
Oh, don't tell me it was in, like, post requests and stuff.
Yeah, and found all the passwords for the users kicking around in the logs, just doing log analysis. And he's actually published some pretty in-depth log analysis, like having a look at where the IEEE members are coming from, which organizations, you know, what the browser stats are, and various other bits and pieces. I mean, the main thing about this is that it looks like it was on the FTP server for at least a month.
Mm.
So anyone may have potentially downloaded it. There's been no real word from IEEE so far about, like, whether or not anyone else managed to get it. And it also the target base, right? So as far as, you know, IEEE membership goes, it's a lot of scientists and like, you know, engineers at some pretty significant organizations like NASA and Oracle and Samsung and Stanford, you know. So, I mean, it's a pretty target-rich list. But as you'd expect, you know, the most popular passwords are 123456.
Yeah, of course.
You know, IEEE 2012.
Just because you're a rocket scientist doesn't mean you're picking good passwords.
Exactly, right? So, yeah. I mean, yeah, it would be interesting to see if they come out saying other people had grabbed that data before this guy responsibly disclosed it.
Well, you know, engineers do dumb things like picking dumb passwords, but they also do other dumb things, which lead us to our next story about the Samsung Galaxy S3. Holy dooly, there was a nice little bug in it which would enable anyone pretty much to just, like, remote wipe the device, which is not a good thing.
Yeah, so I was actually on a customer site yesterday, and when I came back, my Twitter feed and email was just full of this little issue. But basically, Samsung, with their user interface that they distribute with the phones, specifically the Galaxy S3 and a couple of other models, which is called TouchWiz, handles, like, you know, user input in the way that it goes through. Now, with most mobile phones, you'll have what's called, you know, supplementary service data codes, or they basically allow you to access diagnostic functionality or quick access functionality into the underlying device. So one of the codes was remote wipe. And so what they figured out was that you could provide, you know, a link effectively to a user, and if they click on it through the TouchWiz UI, it'll effectively execute the code. So they went ahead and created a nice QR code and demonstrated it at Eco Party last weekend, and basically proved, like, you know, that you can easily wipe the device if you can convince the user to do something stupid.
Like click on a link, which isn't too hard.
Or scan a QR code, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God, look at this photo of you drunk. Click, you know, simple as that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the way that the UI generates the links that the user may click on means that you can even SMS this, right?
So yeah.
You can just be like, hey, here, check this out, and someone will click it and the device is wiped.
And many lulls ensued. But there is an over-the-air update for that one, I believe. So
yeah, apparently, according to Samsung, they have come out, like, it was responsibly disclosed from the looks of it, and they have put out an over-the-air update. But I mean, the problem is with over-the-air updates, right, is it's also dependent on the telco. So it depends on whether or not telcos have actually pushed the update.
Well, that's the big problem with Android, right? And I think a problem with this too is that some guys who looked at the demo actually managed to weaponize this and release malicious, you know, proof of concept out into the wild. So I believe recently, mate, you switched from Android to Apple because of some of the ongoing issues with Android.
Yeah, and some things keep you up at night and some things don't, right? And I've got to say that my iPhone doesn't keep me up at night.
Rightio. Oh, now speaking of all things Apple, Apple TV. There's been a bunch of bugs in Apple TV that have been patched after Apple had sort of sat on them for a few months. 21 vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be at Apple at the moment, you know, wait till at least you've got 20 CVEs that you want to release. Yeah, I mean, it's everything you'd expect, right? It's the handling of the way that, you know, various media files and the web functionalities handled within the Apple device. These look like they may actually be related to other issues that have been found, like, you know, within iOS and various bits of other Apple products, and they're just sort of playing catch up on maintaining the Apple TV. So, yeah.
It's interesting, you know, because I've been just recently I've been watching a live tale of my Apache logs, and you should see the weird devices that hit the risky business feed. It's really strange. There's a few Apple TVs. There's a few, like, it's just strange stuff.
Yeah, I mean, once you start looking around the internet and see what's actually internet connected nowadays, it gets a little bit crazy. You know, Shodan and other projects have really proved that, like, you know, there's a lot of strange things out there online, you know, including TVs.
Now, look, there's been a bit of interesting research come out of RSA, which, I mean, they've, you know, they've tried to coin a new term here, which they call waterholing, which I don't know if it deserves its own term, but what they've noticed is attackers are starting to go after websites that their targets are likely to be browsing. I mean, this isn't really something new, but I guess more actors are starting to operate this way, which is, you know, find a forum where, you know, your targets are likely to frequent this forum, own it, start serving up malware, and, you know, see what you can do.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic retake on the drive-by attack, right? But instead of doing drive-by for every user to the website, what you're trying to do is get drive-by to users that and organizations you want to target. So what they've been doing is, like, a couple of the recent vulnerabilities, including the Java and IE vulnerabilities, were found being used within targeted campaigns. And the way the delivery of the exploit was conducted was by compromising industry forum websites, right? So if it's like the energy sector, they might have, you know, a Green Initiative Consortium, and they'll go and hack the website for the Green Initiative and Consortium, and then they're targeting anyone within the energy sector. I mean, it's nothing really major new, but what's interesting is the fact that a lot of the campaigns that are ongoing at the moment and a lot of the crews that have been doing the campaign work have stopped emailing, right? And they're now targeting these other areas. And we're not 100% sure why. Like, presumably they're getting a pretty good hit rate on other organizations within the same sector.
So are they only serving up badness to, like, originating IPs that they're interested in, or...?
In some cases, yeah. It depends on the type of industry they're going after. We have seen some where they've said, like, explicitly, if they're coming from this area or this you know, organization, hit them. If not, don't worry about it. Other times, you know, they're just like, anyone who's visiting this website, chances are they're a part of this industry.
Well, I mean, it's a really sensible strategy, right, to be selective about who you're throwing up your exploits to, because it makes it harder for people in, say, the security community to actually spot the threat.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things that's gone on a lot over recent times is people have been, and organizations have, you know, really, really focused their effort into filtering mail and having a look at what's coming through email. In this case, because the actual payload doesn't come through email, the odds are the security guys may not necessarily get the sample straight away, and therefore it's more successful. So, yeah, I mean, it's definitely a trend. I mean, this sort of VoHo campaign, as RSA called it, has come out, you know, on the back of Symantec's Outerwood report. They're basically talking about the same crew.
Yeah.
From what I can tell. But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely been increasing over this sort of last, you know, sort of 8 to 9 months, this sort of attack.
Oh, now some news from your homeland. Your Government Communications Security Bureau is in all sorts of shit. The New Zealand Prime Minister has ordered an inquiry because it turns out they were doing, apparently, allegedly, doing sort of communications intercepts on Kim.com and those guys and passing the information to police, which, you know, anyone familiar with the charter of that agency, I mean, that's a complete no-no.
Well, yeah, I mean, effectively, and within New Zealand, we have two agencies. We have the NZSIS and the GCSB. The NZSIS is responsible for snooping upon New Zealand citizens and permanent residents, and the GCSB is responsible for foreign intelligence. And that can include, you know, visitors to the country who don't have permanent residency and are not New Zealand citizens. So from the looks of it, during the dot-com investigation, the police wanted some interception capability relating to the internet services, and which, you know, the GCSB has the capability to provide. GCSB said, is he a New Zealand citizen? The police said, no. They said, great. They issued, like, you know, they went through and started the wiretap or interception, aka spying. And what it turns out is the fact that the police were wrong. He was a permanent New Zealand resident, I think in 2005 or somewhere around there. They did a massive fireworks show in Auckland just to make a point.
Yeah.
So the GCSB kind of failed to, you know, check with the police properly, and the police kind of got it wrong and said, he isn't a New Zealand citizen, which is true, but he was a permanent resident, which they should have disclosed. What's really the story here from our side, over the side of the ditch, is, you know, yeah, shit happens, even in organizations like the GCSB in place, but we have pretty good oversight procedures, which involve ministers and various other, you know, attorney generals and various bits and pieces to ensure that, like when this stuff does happen, like, you know, it's dealt with or shut down immediately and, you know, basically gets checked.
Yeah, well, you've got an equivalent of IGES, which is what, the Inspector General of Intelligence Services or whatever, and that's where this is going to get referred. But it's hard to imagine someone's not going to get spanked over this because the oversight is good.
Yeah, yeah. So basically what it looks like, what happened was John Key, who's the Prime Minister for New Zealand and Minister in charge of the GCSB, wasn't actually informed of this action. So it should have gone through him, and the warrant sign-off should have gone through him. It looks like it went through, like, you know, his deputy at the time, who was acting Prime Minister, Bill English. He signed it off, and, like, you know, I mean, John Key's coming out saying, like, you know, I didn't really know about it. I was shocked about it. But it's really hard to tell what's really going on in there. But, yeah, I mean, basically, it's getting investigated because it was going to come to light from the looks of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And how this would have been handled outside of that, like through the proper, you know, checking processes is where the main concern lies.
Well, I think what's interesting throughout this whole thing, I think what's interesting to me is that from very early on, some lawyers that I know said immediately that the criminal case looked wonky at best. I mean, there's probably going to be a, you know, more of a civil case there, and they can argue about that for years, and they certainly will. But, you know, you got to ask, if there's a pretty thin premise for a criminal case, the fact that the New Zealand police were so eager to get involved in this, and, you know, you had support from intelligence agencies and stuff, it just seems, you know, it really seems like the copyright lobby had a lot of influence over the government in terms of, you know, getting that door kicked down.
Yeah, I mean, I think it wouldn't be so much the copyright industry as much as it would be our relations with our American friends over there.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, we've been seeking, like, you know, to thaw defense relations and various other intelligence relations and law enforcement relations with those guys for some time. It all stems back to the 80s when we told them to piss off with their nukes.
Nuclear ships, and you tore up the ANZUS Treaty.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's only just starting to come through, right? So we had like the New Zealand Declaration last year, and there's, you know, always talk of free trade and various other bits and pieces going on. So politically, I'd say it would be more aligned to, you know, being seen as, like, you know, good class students for the US, I guess, in the way that we're doing it.
So you want to be good kiss asses like Australia.
Yeah, teacher's pet, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Unfortunately, like, as you go through every aspect of this investigation, it's been screwed up. Right? Like the way that evidence was collected and handled, the way that, you know, interception was done, the way that warrants were done, the way that, you know, the liaison with the FBI was done, and pretty much every aspect of this case, right down to now this latest thing with the interception, has fallen apart. Right?
Yeah, well, they didn't just screw the pooch, they wined and dined it first. It was a proper seduction, I think. Yeah, so,
pretty much.
Look, we better move on because we've got a fair bit more to get through. Google has actually paid out a bug bounty for a Windows bug, which is kind of interesting. The lowly sum, though, of only around $5,000.
Yeah, this surprised me, right? So, as we know, you know, Google run the bug bounty program for their software, which Chrome is, you know, the poster child for. And a couple of researchers found a bug that within Windows, but could be exploited through Chrome. So Chrome deems that valid, and therefore, you know, paid them for the bug.
Yeah.
So, which is the first time we've seen this. What's really interesting about this is the fact that Microsoft refused to pay for bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Microsoft won't pay researchers for bugs. So as part of these guys' exploits, you know, they kind of just reported it through, and at the same time, and Google were like, yeah, well, that fits within our mission to secure stuff, so we'll pay for it.
What do we actually know about the bug? Was it remote code exec? I mean, was it anything interesting? Or
I think it was to do with the way that internal communications out of the Chrome sandbox happen on Windows, so probably privilege escalation, I'd say.
Yeah. But they're worth pretty decent coin, though, you know?
Yeah, I mean, any bug in modern Windows is worth decent coin, right? So, I mean, but I think it was more like, you know, a hat tip more than anything, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Oh, now we're going to turn to an interesting story written by Darren Pawley at SC Magazine here in Australia about iOS app piracy. So the piracy of Apple iOS applications. It looks like from this report that it's actually a pretty serious problem.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I think this is a sign of mobile becoming mainstream, right? And iOS becoming mainstream in the sense of, you know, when they started having a look around and they had a look at some of the torrent sites and some of the paid sites as well for the way stuff, you know, gets distributed, they found, you know, pretty much most of the 30 most popular iPhone apps, for within Australia, at least, you know, cracked and available.
And some of these apps are very expensive as well. I mean, it's gotten to the point where, according to this piece, some application developers have just given up.
Yeah, Yeah. And I mean, I think this is, I honestly think this is just teething and maturity for the mobile development industry, right? Like, this has sort of been going on in the PC space for years and years and years and years and years, right? And with the way that Apple have done their App Store and the way they control app distribution, I think developers put all their eggs in one basket and relied on Apple to do that. Now, I don't know off the top of my head whether or not, that's been an enforcement by Apple saying they'll take care of all that and your app won't do that because you can never tell with the Apple iOS rules. But I think it's just a coming of age, right? It's just a maturity. Like, this stuff is worth money. People don't want to pay money for it. They've got a jailbroken iOS device. Why not just download it? Right? Like, that's where it's sort of stemming from. But yeah, definitely the scale of it took me by surprise. I didn't realize it was getting that, those guys were getting that busy. But there should be no real surprise in the sense that it's happening.
No, that is true. But I mean, I think it is the scale. I think that's right. The fact that there is actually a massive burgeoning wares scene, which, I think is almost like writing on the wall. It looks like it's something that could definitely get a lot worse.
And I mean, and some of these, were getting cracked within days of being released as well, which is pretty interesting as well. Like, the speed at which they're turning around, from being published in the App Store to being available for download onto your jailbroken device, for software that could be worth, $1,000 or something, is pretty quick.
Now, we're going to turn to another Australian story here. There was these poor guys, TDC Refrigeration and Electrical, who are a business based in the Northern Territory here in Australia. Some scumbag encrypted up all of their financial records and then demanded a ransom for the decryption. They paid $3,000 and the bad guys didn't decrypt. Just a very sad story.
Yeah, I mean, extortion has been an up-and-coming tactic for crime gangs, right? Like, and especially over within Europe and various other, around Russia and various other places, is we've seen a massive increase in, encrypting the data, flashing up a funny flash screen that says, whatever excuse we've encrypted it. Sometimes they're saying they're government, sometimes they're saying that they're straight up criminals and saying, look, if you send us money to this address, we'll send you the passcode to decrypt it. And the way the malware generally works is that it will, for each device that gets infected and each device that they're successful on, they create a unique key, right? So they're doing some, pretty basic PKI, but effective PKI, and they post the key back off to command and control. So the only people that have the key for the data are those who, are in control of command and control. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty sad, right? Like, extortion generally is a business trade, and they didn't hold up, but whatever.
Well, I think normally, I mean, that's the thing that surprised me about this story is normally when people pay, these guys do cough up the keys, which, I always thought was kind of surprising, but now I'm sort of like reverse surprised that in this case, they didn't get the keys. All right, Mark. Well, that's actually it for this week's news. Thank you very much for being stunt metal this week and filling in for our good buddy Adam, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Pat. It's always a pleasure.
Mark Piper of Insomnia Security joining us for a check of the week's news there. Adam couldn't do the news with us this week, so big thank you to Mark for finding the time to help us out. Up next, it is time for this week's feature interview. Corey Benninger and his colleagues at Intrepidus Group in the USA did an interesting presentation at EUSEC West last week in Amsterdam about public transport ticketing security. As it turns out, many public transport organisations really stuffed up when rolling out their ticketing systems, their sort of RFID, NFC ticketing systems. This research means that if you're using a single-use ticket, it's now likely that it's quite easy to reset the card, the ticket, to its previous state after your journey just by using a simple app for an NFC-equipped cell phone like a Nexus S. So free travel forever and nil chance of getting caught. So I got Corey on the line and asked him to explain why him and his colleagues started looking at ticketing security in the first place.
Well, the company I work for, Intrepidus Group, we just kind of specialize in anything that's mobile-related devices, applications. So we were pretty late in the United States here getting NFC. So when the Nexus S came out and it was going to have a new NFC chip in there, me and my coworker Max were just really interested in diving into it and figuring out, what NFC was. We were total noobs at the time, so. We each got an Nexus S, and anything that was NFC related, we just scanned with the phone. So, while we were on a business trip out in San Francisco, unrelated to anything to do with the transit systems, we just noticed the cards that we got were using NFC, and so we just kind of went to town.
So what did you start looking at? Just the cards? I mean, did you just write some basic scanning or use a basic scanner on your phone to sort of like just grab data off the cards? I mean, how did this research evolve, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, so initially my first time out there, I was having issues with my Nexus S and actually reading the data with my phone itself. So I kind of brought it back up to the hotel room, and we have NFC USB adapters. And LibNFC is a great tool set for just interacting directly with the cards. So we used that to actually pull off the data from a number of the transit cards that we had gotten while we were there, took a look at it, and noticed that the data that was being changed and being sent on those cards were all part of the card that we had full access to. So the first time we discovered the issue, we had to use our laptops to record the data and set it back. And it wasn't until after I left there and came back the next time that I had it working on my Android phone where I could just tap into the phone and read the data and then reset it.
So what was the main problem that you found with this? I mean, because really, obviously, the hacker mentality is we've got these public transport cards that we've paid for. How do we get free trips? I mean, that's obviously where you're going to go with this. So how did you get?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How can I do this?
So how did you get free trips?
What we noticed was the card type that they were using were kind of the original NFC NXP cards called ultralights, and these have just pretty much no access control features that the more expensive and later cards had built into them. So the one control factor that they do have is that the first four pages of the card data, the first three card, first three pages you can never change, and the last page is actually one-time bits. And so those are supposed to be used in these ticketing systems so that once those bits are turned on, you can never send a command to rechange those and set those back off. So that's the whole purpose of these cards for a ticketing system, is you're supposed to knock off those bits with each ride. So after we read the specifications on that card and looking at the data, we realized those bits weren't changing at all with these systems. And that's how we knew we had full access to just go ahead and reset these cards to their original state.
So hang on, there's a protection that means, okay, I did have a look at your slide deck. It means that, like, okay, we've gone through one trip and it burns out one of those bits. Two trips burns out, for all intents and purposes, that's how it works. Now, if you're not supposed to be able to reset these bits, how was it that you were able to?
So the issue is that for one of the transit systems, they're just leaving all those bits unset, and they never check them off when you go through the turnstile. So they're just not ignoring them completely. And with the other transit system, they're setting them to a value, but they never actually increment them. They never actually change them as they get used. So we just don't touch those first four pages of the card. Just leave that data as is and just reset the data in the other pages.
So basically, these tickets do have features that are designed to prevent this sort of manipulation, and public transport authorities just haven't implemented them.
Right. Somehow they didn't understand what that sector of data was supposed to be used for. And it's kind of interesting, the original cards called these an OTP section, a one-time programmable. And now with the later versions of the cards, they actually call these a one-way counter. Same number of bits, same way that they're used, just to make it a little more clear what the function of those are supposed to be used for, I think.
Now, did your research take you down the road of trying to look at manipulating these supposedly unmanipulatable bits?
Yes, actually. So we've had no success with that so far, and I must admit, I'm kind of more on the software side, and my coworker Max understands the RF frequencies and the handshake protocols and everything else way better than I do, and he's kind of taken a better step at trying to get to that at a lower level than I have. But one of the things we did find in our presentation at USAC kind of touched on was we were able to get a knocked-off card from China, where actually we could change some of those values. It has a hidden command in it, which lets you actually set some of those unsettable features, particularly the UID of the card, which is kind of like its serial number. So, $60 and a Chinese email address of where to order that from was one way that we could actually change that data.
Now, what about the process, the ticketing process? Because with a lot of these cards, sometimes, I guess, I'm thinking of the cards in Melbourne, the older ones now, that you'd actually feed into a slot, and that actually have a time or date printed on them. And that, I suppose, gets around a lot of this stuff. But with a wireless card, you're just really tapping it and off you go. So there's no way for a ticket inspector to really have a good idea if a card has been messed with or not, right?
Well, it's kind of interesting. At least the system in San Francisco, they do have some of the ways to enter the system actually is kind of a trust system. They expect that you are going to tap your card, and then when you're riding the bus or the subway, they'll have inspectors that come around and read your card and make sure that you've actually tapped it at one of these stations and used it appropriately. the kind of issue that we found with resetting the card data like this is that, sure, you could go ahead and tap the card, use it as normally. As you're going on the transit system, a inspector comes by, your card looks normal. And then when you get off the system, you reset the data on your card and it looks like you've never used it.
Mm-hmm. And there's no way for them to track it by a serial number or anything like that. I mean, how much tracking do they do on the back end? I suppose it's hard to know, right?
Right, exactly. It's kind of hard to know, although, you know, once we discovered this issue with the two transit systems out here, we did inform both of them. We had a full sit-down meeting with one of the transit agencies to really explain this issue, countermeasures to it. And they actually thought that they would have some sort of fraud detection in place to detect this, but it wasn't being triggered from it. So I kind of agree. I think a server-side sort of check against these cards, monitor for reuse, monitor for abuse, is really something that they'll probably need to implement, especially, you know, has card emulation in your mobile phones takes off. How are you supposed to trust that this card hasn't been tampered with? I think it's going to be a kind of a hard problem for these systems.
But you were saying it's quite difficult to change the serial number. So I would have thought that, you know, I would just assume that you would just keep a log of suspicious serial numbers if you're doing that sort of detection. And then you could just have like a known bad list that you could then give to the inspectors, like put that on their equipment. So when they find one of these cards, they can tackle you to the ground and shoot you.
Yeah, no, you're right that the UID is definitely one of those features that they could be monitoring for and checking in and for, you know, the current state of card emulation right now and for the current price of the ultralights, that is definitely a difficult field for somebody to mess with and change. So I think that would be a good protection to implement for at least for now.
Now, if you just want to get past the turnstiles, there's no reason you can't really use card emulation off your NFC device, right? I mean, if you just don't even want to have a card, you could just have a little, you know, you could pretty much script it, couldn't you? Onto your, you know, Nexus or whatever. You know, I would say iPhone 5, but Apple kind of screwed us with NFC on that. But then you could just like walk up to the turnstiles and go, yeah, I'm a ticket. Woo. I mean, did you get that far with the emulation part?
No. So, BlackBerry devices actually claim to have card emulation support, and their API for BlackBerry 7 actually says that you can set a UID for that card. However, their API, if you follow up in blog posts later on, they actually ignore that value and just use one that they generate. And there's certain ranges of UIDs that are going to be generated for card emulation versus a physical card. So
it just knows it's an emulator and they can lock them out, right?
Right, exactly. So as far as we know at this point, I haven't seen a transit system here in the States use card emulation for authentication. And, you know, it's kind of a hard state to bypass right now, but in the future, that's probably something that can definitely, that's something that I know a lot of people are looking at trying to be able to do.
Now, how old are these systems that you guys were messing with? I think you mentioned San Francisco, maybe Chicago, was that right?
San Francisco and New Jersey are the two transit systems here in the States we're aware of. I'm not exactly sure how old either of these systems are. One of the reasons we really want to call attention to this is because we know other transit systems are looking to implement contactless cards now. You know, we've heard lots of rumors about the one here in New York where we live, trying to go to that system. So it's one of those things we want to bring attention to. So when they're evaluating these systems, they really take a good understanding about what cards they're using and how the security features are actually implemented.
Mm-hmm. Hey, just going back to the card emulation thing, I mean, do you foresee a time coming up quite soon where you will be able to just use your mobile device? Indeed, I think it could be probably a feature that public transport organizations might want to implement so that people can use their phones as tickets.
I agree. I definitely think it's a technology that people want to use. It's a little bit locked down right now how you have to do card emulation, but I definitely think it's something that a lot of systems want to take advantage of. So I agree. I think it's going to be coming here sometime soon.
Now, really what I gather, Corey, from your research is that this problem of basic, you know, not fraud proof, but, you know, fairly secure public transport ticketing, which would make the cost of doing micro fraud sort of prohibitive and not worth doing. It seems like it would be fairly easy to implement. I mean, the key problem here seems to be that they just screwed the pooch when it came to implementation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's kind of the issue that we detected here. And I mean, we don't want to cast blame on either the transit systems here. We've had discussions with them and we know at least one of them, it was a third party that they outsourced to, and they're really expensive bids. They don't really, you know, have good insight into some of this technology. They're really trusting a lot of other people to implement this correctly for them. But yeah, this was, you know, we didn't go to NXP about this issue because they've implemented these cards correctly. It's just the implementation use for these systems isn't taking advantage of those security features.
Well, they're such massively expensive systems. I mean, I know that here in Australia, in Melbourne, they've implemented like a system called MyKey, which was, you know, it went massively over budget and turned into a bit of a political scandal. It seems that these rollouts always wind up going to, you know, they always involve very serious tenders and very serious dollars. You would think that somewhere along the line, with the millions and millions and millions of dollars that are spent, they might actually get one guy in to look at the security of this stuff. Because it's not really rocket science to find the problems that you've identified. It was just a matter that you paid attention.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree with that. And secondly, like if you find this at the time where you're actually designing the system and before you've rolled it out, this is a much easier problem and less costly problem to fix.
Now speaking of that, what is involved in fixing? I mean, we just spoke about maybe being able to track unique card IDs at the back end and like creating a blacklist or whatever. But is there something that they can roll out in terms of a firmware update to the scanners? I mean, is that what would be required, a firmware update to the scan to every single ticket gantry?
Right. I mean, and obviously this gets a little bit outside of the realm of what I have insight into, but my understanding is yes. I mean, it'd be every turnstile would need some sort of software update so that they're marking off these bits on the cards. And every machine that you have that's issuing tickets or however you generate your tickets in the first place needs to be updated so that it's actually setting these bits correctly in the first place. And then secondly, if you want to think down the line of actually implementing some sort of fraud detection to check UIDs or other sorts of abuse, then you need all these systems tied into something in the back end that can monitor for that abuse. So if they built the system without any of those things, you can imagine it could be really costly and time intensive to put those features now into it.
Yeah, that sounds like a hell of a program to go around and actually flash every single ticket scanning device. I mean, would you be able to do it gradually so that you would still maintain backwards compatibility with the crappy way of doing things? I mean, that would be the way to do it, obviously.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's something I don't really have any insight into.
Because, I mean, if it's just a problem that they're not checking off the bits, I mean, you could have some gantries that do and some that don't. And maybe,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, maybe flip the switch into always requiring it. NXP is also trying to get people to upgrade to their Ultralight C cards, which not only still have these one-way counters, the OTP bits, but they also do actually implement access control features so they can actually have triple DES for reading and writing different sectors to the card and actually have a whole more robust system. But, I think that's another thing that would be a costly upgrade for anybody that's using old Ultralights at this point.
Did you guys take a look at the Oyster card yet?
No, actually, we haven't. We kind of limited our research to places we had traveled to recently, and I haven't been anywhere where I could get my hands on the Oyster card.
How many cities have you actually identified as being vulnerable to this?
So we only noticed two cities here in the States. There are some items we've seen online of other cities that are actually using ultralights as well. The thing that's kind of hard. We did order transit cards from a number of different places where we could actually order them either through the website or by mail. But typically those cards that they send are going to be cards that are meant to be refilled and reused, and they actually use a different technology. We found in both of these systems the flaw lies in what's supposed to be disposable tickets, what's supposed to be kind of like one or two times or 10-time use cards and then thrown away.
Well, I suppose it's difficult for you guys to figure out if there's a problem when you don't actually have a gantry to scan it at. You need to be in the city, right? And see the changes on the card.
Right. That's true. And that's one of the reasons why we released one of our apps that you could actually now look at those bits when you scan a card before you use it, look at those bits and the data on the card after you've used it, and it'll give you an indication of what's changed on there. Obviously, there's no way that we can detect if there's a back-end sort of fraud detection system involved in there, but this would at least give somebody with this app on their phone using these tickets a sense of if it's going to be vulnerable to this type of reset attack or not.
Well, look, Corey, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And on behalf of all of the Brocast student listeners in San Francisco and New Jersey who are now going to be getting free trips to campus, I would like to thank you on behalf of them as well. It was a pleasure to chat to you, and we look forward to hearing updates as you progress with your research.
Great. Sounds good, Patrick. Take care.
Corey Benninger of Intrepidus Group there with a chat about public transport security. And I'll throw some links to his slide deck and video in this week's show notes. So just head to risky.biz and look for the show notes for episode 256 for that. Also, if you're interested, you can follow me on Twitter. I am just Risky Business, one word. And it's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Mr. Ron Gula. Ron is the co-founder and chief executive of Tenable Network Security. And Tenable has some interesting news. It has just raised $50 million from venture capital firm Accel and announced a strategic relationship with InQtel. So there's all sorts of interesting stuff going on with those guys at the moment. But this week, I thought it would be interesting to get Ron's thoughts on a possible plan by US President Barack Obama to issue an executive order that would have a similar effect to the passage of the Cybersecurity Act of 2012. Now, regular listeners would know that that act was shot down in Congress. So I got Ron on the line and I asked him what he thought about the idea of regulating through executive edict.
I think it's a really interesting premise because it's hard to regulate security and actually, you know, get to anywhere that that people can look at and go, you know, hey, let's move on. You know, the power industry is great because you see things like, you know, fences and guards and you know, there's all sorts of regulations for generating things like nuclear power and stuff like that. And people say, you know, where are the regulations for, you know, protecting these assets, you know, on the internet? But the reality is there are some regulations out there already. You know, we just want a little bit more. And I say we as an industry. Sharing, you know, doing different things like, you know, having better minimum baselines, they're all really, really good things. But what people don't really realize is how much the government is already involved in these things. I mean, you know, things like Einstein protect, you know, government agencies like the Tennessee Valley Authority that are completely government-owned here in the U.S. So there's a lot of interest already. So it's very interesting that the bill didn't get passed. It's very interesting that the Obama administration wants to do even more executive orders. And, you know, that's something that if you're outside, you know, the U.S., I don't know if you have an appreciation for that. I mean, the president can just say, we're going to go do this, right? It's not necessarily a law, but it's definitely, you know, it tells certain portions of the U.S. government to pretty much go do this. You know, a lot of people forget that the president of the United States actually runs, you know, the executive portion of the government. So certain places like, you know, Veterans Administration, Tennessee, those people all report to the president eventually. And you know, there's a lot of things that can be done these ways.
But it is interesting. I mean, I take your point that it's very difficult to legislate for a bare minimum of security. And certainly putting together anything that is a prescriptive bit of legislation seems, you know, pointless, essentially. But putting together an in-principle sort of idea seems maybe not so bad. It seemed that what the draft legislation wanted was for the industry to sort of be forced into a position where it had to self-regulate and people, they needed to define for themselves what best practice was and adhere to that.
You know, well, there's the industry, right? And then there's, you know, what are people doing anyway? If you look at the nuclear power industry, a lot of those guys are Tenable customers, right? And we will go into them and we talk about, you know, cybersecurity and viruses and hackers and stuff like that. And some of these guys look at us and say, you know, Sonny, you know, we've been generating power here reliably for 100 years, you know, for a very, very long time. We're much more worried about, you know, lightning storms and tsunamis and earthquakes and heat waves than we are about, you know, maybe some hackers flipping a switch here and there. But the reality is every year, you know, more and more these power things are put online. And when I say put online, you know, managed with, you know, an IP network, managed with an internet, you know, reachable device. And we've heard all about all these, you know, home power systems that are, you know, IPv6 addressable and hackable, you know, from Wi-Fi and things like that. And those things are realities. But, you know, to tell somebody that they're generating power who isn't on the internet, right, that they are subject to, you know, these new regulations and things like that, some of the times it's almost nonsensical. In other cases, you actually do have people who have, you know, power generating devices directly connected to the internet, you know, with web interfaces and all these kind of you know, these things that you see on Shodan and things like that. So it does make you wonder, but I just don't think regulation is more what we need at this point.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that makes me, the one area where it gets me a little bit spooked, right, is we're seeing countries that are hostile towards Western power, I'm thinking specifically of Iran. They seem to be building a very sophisticated capability in a very short period of time. I mean, they're landing drones. It's my suspicion that they may have been involved in the attacks against Saudi Aramco. Just my gut feel. We had the Komodo hacker stuff, all of that SSL stuff, and it was very clear that that was being used by the government, just based on the number of man-in-the-middle attempts that telemetry showed us, you know, were happening. So I would really imagine that these guys are going to be trying to get a foothold in American critical infrastructure, that there are going to be state-sponsored actors that are really going hard for this stuff. I mean, do you think that the critical infrastructure sector in the United States is at all ready to face that sort of threat?
So my answer is, I believe there are certainly forces in the world who are going to try to do things to disrupt perhaps the U.S. infrastructure, Western infrastructure, things like that. I mean, without a doubt, those things are out there. However, I'm a big student of sort of the Marcus Rainham School of cyber warfare, right? Marcus has been going all over the world talking about cyber warfare. And, you know, cyber warfare is a great analogy, but it just doesn't scale, right? You can't occupy something. You can't really do hard kills. You can't really do a lot of things that you want to really do from a warfare point of view. Now, tactically, sure. Can I hack in and steal something? Yeah, all the time, right? Can I hack in and change data? Sure, all the time. You know, can you apply that to warfare? Not the same way like a Tomahawk missile. I mean, not the same way as jamming a system and, you know, the boots on the ground and those, like, is it a tool in the arsenal? Sure. Right. So it's very interesting. I thought it was interesting that, you know, everybody is crediting Iran with attacking the petroleum company you mentioned, the Aramco. But at the same time, Iran was accused of launching denial of service attacks at, the Bank of America, you know, here in the United States. And that was then denied. So I think as an industry, we're really, really, really good at giving these magical powers to whoever it is, whether it's anonymous, Al-Qaeda, or Iran's, you know, cyber warfare capabilities. So it's definitely interesting times.
Yeah, no, it is. I guess, you know, from the warfare point of view, though, I mean, some of these sort of online strikes could be used in place of traditional strikes. I mean, you think about when some country does something to piss off America, there might be an attack at a checkpoint or something like that. Some soldiers are killed. They might take out an airfield. They might take out a bridge that has some sort of military significance. They might just generally make life hard for their adversary. And I think, you know, that's why something like the Saudi Aramco attack is interesting. It was almost like a shot across the bow saying, we can get to you. We can make your life hard. And that has been a purpose of you know, sort of more kinetic strikes in the past, surely.
I think you're using a something that happened, and you're associating it with Iran. I think if Iran came out and said that they did that, that'd be a little bit different than speculating about it. I'm not convinced that somebody like you or I couldn't have hacked into Aramco and broken into 30,000 computers like that. I know tons of people who write, you know, client-side attacks who do that thing, you know, for paid resources.
So it could have been some college kids just having some shits and giggles, basically.
I'm not going to say that, but, you know, if you type in and you look at the type of people who go to DEF CON and Black Hat and stuff like that, and for the good guys, you know, I mean, it's a lot of these guys out there who do penetration testing. Like, what do? Hey, I get hired by oil companies, you know, power companies, and I get in every time. Really? Mm-hmm. Are you using some? No, I'm using SET. I'm using stock, you know, client-side attacks. I'm using things like, these zero days that are out there. So if we can do it, I'm sure, you know, somebody else can do it, right? Now, the question is that the advanced cyber warfare capability of, you know, a terrorist group of Iran, of something like that? We're speculating. You know, we really, really are.
Well, and I think bringing it back to the original point of this conversation is that it's unlikely that an executive order or, you know, legislated standards or practices are going to do much to change that.
And it's also unlikely that a well-funded adversary whose goal is to take out power in a certain region is going to be stopped by that. They're going to. It doesn't matter what defenses you have. The defenses that you have are only going to be good up to a point, because you're going to spend defenses at a point where, you know, I think I'm quoting Robert Graham. Just did a great post on something along these cyber. What Rob Graham of Radisec, where he says, look, you know, we're spending a dollar to not to save a dollar, but to protect. We're spending $2 to protect a dollar almost. You know, and I feel bad for not quoting it exactly. I don't have it in front of me, but the point is if you pick a standard like PCI. PCI is great for keeping basic attackers off your website and have a basic level there. But if I'm, you know, if I'm the mob, right, or if I really, really want to steal, you know, 10 million credit cards, I can probably do it by spending a couple million dollars, no problem, right? Buying people off, doing technical attacks, you know, buying 0 days. It's not a problem to spend a couple million dollars to steal millions and millions of dollars, right? Mm. And if my goal is mayhem, right? If my goal is to really, you know, cause terror, spending a couple million dollars doing that is not a big deal. I think that's the thing everybody kind of loses sight of when they think about warfare. People who really, really are well resourced and want to do us harm or want to do, you know, really bad things to the infrastructure, they're not going to be too worried about you know, our patch levels or things like that, because if that's, you know, what's not going to keep them out, they're going to do another technique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting idea. I mean, I just wonder if perhaps as a middle ground, there might be some sort of more general reform. But I guess laws already exist, which provide company directors, which make company directors liable to an extent if they're negligent in terms of securing the you know, their business's assets, right?
It's very true. There's a lot of laws out there, and some of these laws are really conflicting, right? Like, I mean, if you're a public company, for example, you're a publicly traded company to generate profit, your goal is to, you know, have an efficient business with not a lot of overhead, right? Your goal is not necessarily to be, you know, a national infrastructure, you know, player. So, I mean, I'm sure there's some CFOs for some of these big energy companies like, oh, please, please, we don't want to be critical infrastructure, right? You know, we don't want to be
yeah, no, I can imagine they're struggling to redefine themselves.
Right. Like for example, if I'm FedEx, this is something I told people the other day. It's like, if I'm FedEx or I'm UPS, I might be considered critical infrastructure for Amazon, right? I might be considered critical infrastructure for some shipping business, right? Their business might fail if they had to rely maybe on the U.S. postal system, which is excellent, right? But it doesn't give you the same terms and conditions as maybe FedEx and those things. Mm. So if you were able to do some sort of technical attack against FedEx, you know, these kind of things, but then you really, really quickly get into movie plot cyber terrorism, right? Where you start, I think Bruce Schneier has got a whole series of these things where people just come up with, well, this is dependent upon this, and this is dependent upon this, and you know, if you can take this out, then it'll have this domino effect, and it's all very plausible. But then when you really start looking at it, you realize that nobody who has anything here that they're talking about really has any deep knowledge of these things, and you realize the system's very complex and it's hard to understand, and it makes it even harder to regulate.
All right, Ron Gula, always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and I'm sure we'll speak to you again soon.
Hey, absolutely. And all my best wishes to everybody in the Southern Hemisphere.
Tenable Network Security's Chief Executive Ron Gula there, and big thanks to Tenable for its continued support of the Risky Business Podcast. Tenable has sponsored us solidly for 5 years now, so massive, massive thanks to Ron and the entire Tenable team. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is from a Melbourne band called the Public Opinion Afro Orchestra, and it is called Shake. It's really awesome stuff, and you can actually download it for free, so just follow the link from this week's show notes. They recorded this one live onto 8-track analog, just to be a bit old school. And that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.